If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
I don't see what the actual defense is. He signed the checks. It's clear it helped him. He knew about the payments. I think they got plenty enough to convict.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All. To Sarah, I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and we were going to do this podcast yesterday, but we got a surprise witness in the Stormy Daniels case, Hope Hicks. So George and I are both in our undisclosed Saturday locations trying to get you guys the full story. But before we jump into it, I want to remind everybody, George and I are going to be at 6th and I in Washington, D.C. on May 15th.
Where is 6th and I located?
7th and G. It's at 6th and I. 6th and I.
It's a
those
big venue,
streets. Guys. A big venue. So we need, I need you guys to come turn out, fill that place up. We got a lot of people coming, but it holds 700 people. So get your tickets now. Come hang out with us. We're going to do it live. And now we're going to do it taped. George, let's talk about the New York election interference, hush money trial. I saw your tweet that Trump glared at you on his way out of the courtroom.
That was Tuesday. That was Tuesday.
I know, old
That's
news.
Old news, yeah.
But maybe just like give us a little flavor of inside the room real quick.
All right, so the way the room's set up, it's a reasonably large courtroom. I think it would fit anywhere from 70 to 90 people. And there's a center aisle, kind of like in a church or any other courtroom you'd see. And then there's a bar. And then in front of the bar, you have the lawyers' tables. And on the right by the bar, in front of the bar, is the jury box where you have 18 jurors and two rows of nine who are, that includes 12 regular jurors and six alternates, should any of the 12 regular people be unable to complete the trial. And the Trump team is on the left, the prosecution is on the right, the judge obviously in the center, and there are a couple of court officers. And what happens every day is that the spectators, who are mostly in the courtroom, it's mostly media. There are a few people from the general public who get in, but the media does have priority, and there's a list for them. They situate you in the courtroom anytime between 8:30 and 9. Court proceedings usually start at 9:30 or 10, at 9:30, I think. And so what happens is when the former president of the United States gets into the courthouse, there is a certain lockdown procedure that occurs, and basically you are stuck in the courtroom and you have to wait and you can't go to the bathroom and you have to sit there and wait for his team to come in and out, including the prosecutors. And then the same procedure is followed during any break, including the lunch break, where then there's a kind of a freeze in the courtroom. The Secret Service and the court officers allow the Trump people to leave to go to their own separate room, I guess. And then once they are secure in that separate room, everyone else can leave. So you have to sit there while waiting for Trump and their people to leave. So you sit, and he leaves through that center aisle, through the back door of the courtroom. And if you are on the aisle, he will see you. You're within his peripheral vision, and he doesn't scan the entire courtroom, at least two times I was there when he was there. But he saw me at the first morning break as he was leaving the courtroom. And he looked and he gave me this. I was on the right side of the courtroom, so he's looking at the left, and he sees me and his eyes kind of squint. And, you know, he didn't say anything, but he gave me a look. And I smiled at him. I said, And that was, it was very quick. It was, the interaction was, you know, maybe a second, because I don't think he saw me until about, he was like 2 feet away. That's what happened. It was sort of anticlimactic, and but I had fun telling the story on TV, and the person who got the most, biggest kick out of it was on Thursday, the reason why I think I wasn't able to go see the Hope Hicks testimony on Friday is I had this big dental appointment on Thursday morning, and
smile could be really good at him?
Yeah, no, I mean, I had, you know, I have all sorts of issues with my teeth. I had cancer surgery 20 years ago, and then, you know, I have a guy who's doing a really, really good job right now, and I spend a lot of time with him, and he's very proud of my smile. And I told him this story, and he was proud as a peacock. I think he's, I think I'm going to get a whole section on his website for this one.
That's amazing. Okay. So the one other thing I want to ask about that's just like a weird thing that people talk about, is Trump falling asleep in the courtroom? Like, is that a real thing?
Yeah. I mean, he has been, and I have not personally watched it. I think you have to, I tend to look down and close my eyes myself, but I'm actually listening to the testimony. Mm-hmm. He's sitting up front, and there were a couple of occasions, according to the reporters who were there, where he, he was closing his eyes, which is not uncommon in a courtroom. But you know the thing, you've seen people do it on the train or on the plane, they do this, and they go,
yeah.
And that, he did that a couple of times. And Norm Eisen said he did it again, Trump did it again on Friday morning. And Friday morning wasn't the most scintillating of times, because it wasn't the most interesting testimony, because it wasn't interesting until Friday afternoon when Hope testified. I know there's a lot, the Biden campaign has a lot of fun with it. I've had some fun with it. And I think the reason why everyone has fun with it is because he, you know, mocks everyone else as being
Sleepy Joe,
and he has this image of being high energy because he's screaming all the time and he's yelling all the time. But the fact of the
big lunatic energy,
big lunatic energy that seems to carry the day, even if people are not. You know, even if he's acting completely insane and talking completely incoherently for some reason, a lot of people who think that's good. But anyway, his reputation has been that he is Sleepy Don. I mean, no question he's got a lot of energy. I mean, but not in the mornings. I mean, I remember I've talked to people, and in particular, the person who has a lot to say about this is Tim O'Brien, who wrote basically a biography of Trump, and actually did get some cooperation from him, and then Trump sued him, and then, you know, Trump had dropped the case.
Story as old as time.
And Tim basically says the guy never showed up until 11 or 12 at Trump Tower, even the height of his business. And he's not used to working very hard. And we all read the stories during Trump's administration, and he was never in the Oval Office in the morning until 11. If I tweet a little, he'd sleep in, he'd tweet a little, and he didn't even bother a lot of times having the important intelligence briefing that the president is entitled to and should receive every day of the week, every weekday of the weekend, and sometimes on weekends. And so, you know, he's always been Sleepy Don, and this has got to be a toll on him. It's tough to be in a courtroom every day. It really is, because you have to be, you know, particularly when you're sitting up front and you're sitting in front of the jury, you want to show respect for the judge. Something may happen that may require your input or to change a strategy. And it is tough, particularly for trial lawyers who are there. And then they go home. They don't go home. They go out back to their offices, and they have to prepare examination sheets for the next witnesses or in limine motions. I mean, being on trial is really, really rough. And it's rough on litigants. But, you know, I mean, we're supposed to have Superman here. And so we kind of have a little fun with that.
Okay. So the other thing...
But then he issued a tweet. Then he issued a tweet saying, I was simply closing my big, beautiful eyes.
Oh, he did say that, with the big, beautiful eyes. What a weirdo. Those are the moments where, like,
Trump, you think Donald Trump is weird? I'm starting to come to that conclusion.
It's just weird stuff to talk about his own big beautiful eyes.
Because he's a narcissist. This is a classic textbook. Like, he's the most narcissistic human being you will ever, ever, ever see.
So strange.
Yes, ma'am.
Different part of his face. He's got a gag order against him. But I just want to ask one quick question about the gag order stuff. So they're fining him $1,000 is the maximum they can fine him.
Right.
These gag orders. So it's like, he's got like a $9,000 fine, but he just keeps violating it. That's too low. Right. He has no incentive to not violate it.
And the judge
What's the point?
Well, I mean, look, I mean, for some reason, that's what the statute says. It was probably, you know, it wasn't intended to deal with billionaires or alleged billionaires in the year 2024. I don't know when it was set. For most people, $1,000 would be meaningful. But it's clearly not for him. And the judge, in his opinion, expressed that problem. But the statute is what the statute says. Still, there are alternative sanctions that the court can impose, including incarceration for some period of time up to a month. And I think what the judge did in his first opinion on the gag order violations, in which he held that 9 of the 10 alleged violations were in fact violations, which is why there was a $9,000 fine that he paid yesterday, said that at some point he's going to have to consider other measures, including incarceration. And there was a second hearing this week on further violations. And I think what's going to happen is that the judge is going to rule next week and say, you know, here are $3,000 or $4,000 more in fines. But now that you've been warned twice and you've been sanctioned $13,000 or whatever the amount is, and we've made clear that, you know, you should understand by now what the terms of the gag order are and how, particularly by looking at how it has been implied with these violations, the next time I may put you in the clink. And I don't think he has to put the guy in there for 30 days. I think he just needs to, he just could say, you're going to go sit in the holding cell. I think there are holding cells in 100 Center. I'm not sure. They closed the Tombs, which was next door, which would be sweet if they put him in the Tombs. They could bus him up to Riker, but that seems kind of too elaborate and probably would be bad for traffic on the FDR drive. So I don't know if I'm for that.
It's so, just funny.
I would put him, I would say on Monday, I would say, I'm holding you in contempt again. You are being repetitively contumacious, and the next violation of anything like this, you will be incarcerated.
Yeah.
And, I would do it for an hour or two.
Yeah.
And then if he does it again, I'd double it. And if he does it for the third time, I'd make him sit in a holding cell for a day.
Yeah, they're more like timeouts. You know, it's like he's got to put him in timeout.
You know, yeah, literally, and that's too. That's actually a helpful way to phrase it. If I were the judge, I mean, this is now I'm playing. It just occurred to me. It's like he's going to say this is outrageous. I treated this, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, if I were the judge, I would say, you seem not to be able to follow any simple directions. And, I mean, I hate to do this, but essentially this is like a timeout for a toddler.
Yeah.
And I would say that, okay, because I think, from a standpoint of public consumption, it just puts it back on him mm-hmm. and shows that, you hold the keys to your own incarceration here. You're doing this to yourself, Mr. Trump. And you're not helping yourself.
Yeah.
Okay.
It would be really funny if the only way that Trump sees the inside of a jail is simply because he can't keep his mouth shut. Like, he'll never go to jail, but like, actually, he ends up just in there for like regular for hours because he can't shut up.
No, it's weirdly fitting. It's sort of like weirdly fitting that this unseemly, tawdry story produced the campaign finance violation and correlatively a business records falsification violation. There's something perfect about that because he is such a tawdry and sleazy individual. But we'll see.
All right. So I want to talk about the big witness that's not Hope Hicks, but the big witness this week before Hope Hicks was Keith Davidson, the lawyer who represented both Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, who was the former Playboy model who also claimed to have an affair with Trump. And there's one thing about his testimony I want to ask about, because I've seen some commentary about it online, and JVL and I talked about it on the Secret Pod. So Davidson sent a text to a former editor at the National Enquirer on Election Day in 2016 saying, "What have we done?" And Davidson's asked, you know, "Hey, what did you mean by that?" And he said, "There was an understanding that our efforts may have in some way assisted the presidential campaign of Donald Trump." So how does this relate to Trump's intent? Because everybody's, the commentary I was reading, and I saw Norm, speaking of Norm Eisen, wrote something about this, that like, this proved that Trump's intent around election interference. To me, it seems like it proves Keith Davidson's intent or Keith Davidson's state of mind. But I wasn't sure that it proved anything about Trump's. But people seem to think this was a big deal. So tell me about that.
It does prove about Trump's, because Trump ultimately agreed to pay and to reimburse this money. And the timing, I mean, I think there's going to be evidence. It hasn't quite come in, and it probably will come in from Cohen. But basically, Trump was suggesting that they stiff Stormy by basically waiting until the election when it wouldn't matter. So, I mean, there's some of that. And the fact of the matter is, if it doesn't, Trump's intent does matter with respect to the campaign finance predicate for this, but it doesn't completely matter, because if Michael Cohen was pre-funding the $130,000, as you know, you're familiar with the Federal Election Campaign Act, that has to be disclosed.
Right.
I mean, it is an unlawful contribution in excess of the legal maximum of whatever it was in 2016 of $5,600. I don't remember what it was. And so if there was an intent there, I don't think it really necessarily has to be Trump's. There has to be just a violation that he was participating in. I guess there was. I guess that does require some intent, but that's, you know, the pecker pre-process there, the pecker, the modus operandi of having some cutout, pay money to silence women, and that was all clearly for the benefit of the campaign, and you know, Trump knew about it, and that's what Hope Hicks' testimony later establishes. And the fact that he knew that those payments he made in 2017 to Michael Cohen were for reimbursing him for something that was part of a process designed to help his campaign. I mean, that's all she wrote. That's all they need. So I don't understand the point that's being made that suggests that, oh well, you know, it's just Davidson. No, no, no. That said, that would have been my cross of almost any of these witnesses, is that, well, you never talked to Donald Trump, right? You don't know what Donald Trump told Michael Cohen. You don't know what Michael Cohen was telling Donald Trump other than from Michael Cohen. And you thought Michael Cohen was lying to you, right? You thought he was a liar. You thought he was playing games with you. You thought, you know, you said that, right? No further questions. And that would have been the approach I took to Davidson. That would have been the approach I would have taken to the banker for Michael Cohen. His name I don't remember, but he was the first Republic Bank personal banker for Michael Cohen, who basically arranged for the creation of Essential Consultants, the vehicle that was used to, you know, kite the money from Michael Cohen's home equity loan to Davidson and Daniels.
Yeah, and I just, to be clear, because you're right, the FEC filings are just like, they are standard if you're doing anything to influence an election. Like, this right. is, I think people often don't actually know this particular piece of it, but so like, I would know this because whenever we run an ad designed to defeat Donald Trump through what? Republican voters against Trump, the PAC, we yeah. file. Like, we have to publicly say, here's what it is, and here's how much money we spent on it, and here's the purpose of this. Like, it is to, because they could like then, like, put them in a column,
you could say for electing Biden or for not electing Trump, you have to
specify. You do have to specify. And like, so, and that's, it's like compliance. If you do politics, right, or you're running a campaign, you have a bunch of lawyers and a bunch of people there who are designed for compliance reasons to make sure you don't run afoul of the FEC.
Right.
And so
it's easy to make mistakes, but that's why you source it out to people who do this for a living. And it's tedious, but it has to be done. And it's the law.
And that's where sometimes you're right. People do make mistakes and like you can get fined and you can rectify them or whatever. But this is where the case, this case sort of hinges on the fact that they were doing all this stuff. The reason there's like weird home equity loans and this and Michael Cohen was paying.
It was
all about them get around this law.
It was highly, highly, highly irregular. And, you know, at the end of the story, at the end of the day, that's why they created this false invoice and fake retention system. I mean, lawyer retention BS. And he signed those checks. And when you sign checks, you're a businesswoman. I was a partner in a law firm. When you sign checks on behalf of the entity, the accounting people give you a packet. They give you the check stub and the check attached, and behind it, the invoice and other backup showing you that this is a legitimate expense, so that you can see that, okay, we're paying the electric bill or we're paying the lawyer. So that, you know, that's the standard practice. And when you're running a business,
you sign off on the bills.
Big or small,
you sign off on the bills.
And there's the, you know, the people who are your bookkeeper puts these little, and, you know, he's looking at this stuff, says legal retainer. He signs it. He knew what it was for. It wasn't for that. It was all falsified, you know, as also furthered by the fact that they grossed it up to pretend it was income to Cohen.
Yeah.
And so, okay. So was there anything else about Davidson's testimony that you found really notable? Because people seem to think this was, and maybe I'll ask it almost slightly different way. People's impression of the case so far is that it's going better than they could have even expected. That some of the testimony that they're getting is just so, it's just nailing Trump. Yeah. So go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, I saw the direct testimony, a large chunk of Davidson's direct testimony on Tuesday, and I thought he was a very, very effective witness. I thought he was kind of very businesslike. I mean, you know, I had an image of somebody who's practicing law in that area where they're, which is a little, you know, kind of sleazy, I guess, in its effect. He was very lawyerly, very composed, very straight-laced in a way. He kept referring to Stormy Daniels McDougal's involvement with Trump as interactions. You wouldn't say sexual relations or affair or anything like that. Well, he would use the words interactions to refer to Trump's interactions with these women. Davidson, I thought, was fine. I thought he did a very nice job explaining how the Stormy Daniels deal came about. And there were a couple of things I thought that were most significant about that. And one was when he was brought in, he was told that he didn't have to really do that much because basically the deals were structured in the same, they were basically just new versions of the deals that would have been cut with AMI. And so that is really great for the prosecution because it shows that this was part of the same program or conspiracy to basically use hush money payments kited through third parties to for the benefit of the campaign. And that was a very important testimony.
Great. Okay, now I want to get to the big bombshell testimony yesterday with Hope Hicks. We were texting about it because we were going to record yesterday afternoon. And I was like, okay, are you in the courtroom as it was happening? And you were like, no. And I'm so mad about it. But did people have any idea that Hope Hicks was going to appear as a witness?
Yeah, I heard the day before a television producer, I won't say which show, which network, said, hey, We're hearing that it's possible that Hope Hicks would be testifying tomorrow. Could you come up? Are you going to be in New York, and can you be live on set? You know, after the testimony. And I said, oh my God, is that true? Is she really going to go? Because if she was, I would have done anything. I would have taken the mail train on the Amtrak at 10 at night or 2 in the morning, whenever it is, or driven through the night to get to New York to see that testimony. And at the end of the day, I couldn't confirm it. Some people were poo-pooing it. You know how these rumors are. We don't know where they come from. It could be that somebody saw Hope Hicks at a Starbucks in Lower Manhattan near the DA's office. I don't know. It could be that Hope told a friend who told a friend who told. We just don't know how these rumors come about. And my thinking was that Hope's a pretty good witness, and they're probably going to save her to the end, because I don't know that you want to end on Cohen, because there's a little. Yeah, it's a little unclear how Cohen is going to come out and whether the jury will like him. But if Hope's testimony is as good as people were thinking, she would be a great witness to end on, and she would have been a great witness to end on. But it wasn't. There's nothing wrong with them putting her on before Cohen, because she really, really corroborates Cohen like everybody else who has been appearing. So I didn't go, and then I heard right after lunch, oh, it's Hope. They just put Hope on, and I was like, oh. It was like I knew it was going to be one of the biggest moments of the trial, and it's like one of those regrets. It's like I regret not having bought tickets to Game 7 of the 1997 Rangers Canucks Stanley Cup Final game. This is one of my great regrets in life, is not going up to New York yesterday.
Oh man, brutal. Getting you fresh off of a big life regret. That's tough. Well, it sounded like she was very, like, based on the reports, and I'm sure at this point you've read, the transcript or whatever is available from her deal. But, you got it right there. She sounds like she was a very compelling and likable witness for the prosecution. She even got, choked up at one point. So, just tell us the Hope Hicks of it all.
From all reports, everyone I've talked to, people I saw in the courtroom and reading the transcript, she was a very powerful witness. And she's a powerful witness because she had direct communications with Donald Trump. And the most direct communication she had, the most important of those direct communications, was she had with Donald Trump. First of all, her preliminary importance was she basically gave the inside view of what was going on in the Trump campaign during that last month, between the moment she got the email from David Fahrenthold of the Washington Post saying the Post was about to run a story on the Access Hollywood tape, and then to the election. And she gave some very clear, very emphatic testimony about how the Trump campaign went into total crisis mode because of the Access Hollywood tape, and basically how that became a big sensitivity going forward in the campaign, the possibility of women coming forward or another Access Hollywood type, and that they were on high alert, and how all of this was critical to the campaign. I mean, it was the, my language here, was the October surprise that you always wonder about in any campaign, and this was pretty big. And I remember personally, this is not in the testimony, but maybe you remember. I mean, I remember how big it was. I remember driving my ex-wife to Trump Tower that Saturday. I mean, it was red alert. And the thing that I always thought, and Hope testified that they thought the same thing. I always thought there was going to be another tape, because if I'm sitting on these things, right? If I have tapes and I want to sink the Trump campaign, I probably would have waited a week or two more to get it closer to the campaign instead of October 7th. I would have waited a couple of weeks more so that the impact would have been more direct at the end of the campaign. That's what when they came up, that somebody came up with something about a DUI for
Bush,
George W. Bush, and it was like the week before the election. And so I thought, if they drop this one on October 7th, there must be something else. You could basically paralyze the campaign. Turned out there wasn't such tape, or at least it wasn't that, maybe it's sitting somewhere in a vault somewhere. But the whole point of that is to show how concerned they were with further allegations that would reinforce the perception of Trump's misogyny that was created by the Access Hollywood tape. And so that was one very, very important element of Hope Hicks's testimony. And it was just emphatic. It was just it was clean, and it was very effective for the prosecution. And then the other moment was kind of dramatic, and it was at the end of the direct testimony elicited by the prosecution. One of the things you try to do if you are a lawyer, usually if you're the plaintiff's lawyer or a prosecutor, or when you're putting on a witness, you want to end your direct examinations of particular witnesses on a high note, something that's what the jury or the finder of fact, if it's the judge, remembers, like, wow, you know, you hit that high note, and that's what you want to end with. And particularly when it's on a Friday, you know, you want to end Friday with something.
So they
really
can think about it all weekend.
Right. Yeah. You think about it all weekend. It really impactful and is really impactful. And they did that. And the testimony was about how Donald Trump in 2018, I guess, when the story came out that Michael Cohen had paid money to keep Stormy Daniels silent, and then their cover story at that point was, oh, Michael just did this on his own, Donald didn't know about it, and they had a conversation about it, Hope Hicks and the president. And basically he said, oh, Michael did this on his own. I didn't know about it. He did this because he loves me so much, or whatever. And what that shows in and of itself, even apart from whether or not it was the statement was true about whether or not it was done without Trump's knowledge in the first instance, was it shows that he knew about the payment, at least immediately after it was made, and he knew that the payment was made, and he reimbursed the guy for the payment. I mean, he wrote these checks to reimburse, so basically he knew, you know, he's got these packets from the bookkeepers that we talked about, and they say legal retainer on it. He knew that was false. So that goes directly to his intent in falsifying business records under New York law. It's devastating testimony. What was even more devastating about it was, and the prosecution did a nice job getting this out, because if they had asked the question of Hope, did you believe Donald Trump when he said that he didn't know that Michael Cohen had made the payment in the first instance, right? Which is a cockamamie story in a lot of ways, but it's cockamamie because, you know, Michael Cohen's going to take out $130,000 on his home equity loan and be personally on the hook for that without any kind of expectation of reimbursement? I don't think so. It's a lot of money.
You know, just real quick, because Michael Cohen doesn't strike me as a guy who just does this out of, like, the goodness of his heart, you know?
But that's where I'm going.
Okay,
that's where I'm going. So if the prosecutor had asked the question, did you believe Donald Trump? That probably would have been an objectionable question, because it would be speculation about the mind of Donald Trump, basically on the basis of something, you know, it's an inference. So they asked the question very cleverly, and the defense didn't object, and it basically the same answer got in. They asked, was that, what Trump basically said, oh, Michael did that out of the goodness of his heart and blah, 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 because he loves me so much. And, you know, that it was just this act of great generosity by Michael Cohen. And they asked her, is that consistent with your experience with Michael Cohen? And she said, oh, no. Michael wants credit for everything. And it was like clear as a bell on the transcript and in the courtroom that she didn't believe Donald Trump's BS story, which was a great bonus for the prosecution. And that is what they ended the direct testimony on, that high note. And then Bovey gets up, the examiner who is cross-examining on he's Trump's lawyer, and he's cross-examining Hope. And he starts asking questions like, and you worked for the Trump family for so many years. And she broke down. She broke down crying. That was just, the emotions just overcame her at that moment. And, you know, we don't know exactly what was going on in her head. It could be just the stress of it all, but it could be, you know, she was a reluctant witness. She did not want to be there. Maybe she felt bad that she was harming this family who had done so much for her in launching her career. I don't know. Maybe it was just the stress of the, you know, the stress of the duality or the cognitive dissonance that a lot of people who work for Trump and support Trump, as you know, as we've all seen, kind of experience. And it gets very hard at times. And there she was. And she didn't really like attention. She doesn't really like the personal attention. And so, you know, she broke down. And to me, I would be arguing for the jury. And if I were on the jury, I would already conclude, wow, she's not doing this because she wants to screw Donald Trump. She's saying this because it's true. And she's compelled to tell the truth. And that is just, to me, that was the moment where, I mean, if you were a screenwriter writing a script for a Law and Order episode on something like this, or a movie, not that anyone would believe how absurd the underlying facts are, you would write that in there for that reason, to show how dramatic it was and to make that witness so compelling. And if the prosecution could not. They must have, I'm sure they don't want to take personal joy in someone's emotional distress. But from a standpoint of impressing the jury and convincing the jury, wow, you could not have asked for anything more if you're a prosecutor.
There was one other sort of National Enquirer guy, this guy, Dylan Howard, that I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that came out in court this week is that he texted, I can't remember if it was a family member or somebody, but he texted and said, at least if he wins, I'll be pardoned for election fraud, which also seemed notable that the people around him knew clearly that it was, in fact, election fraud.
Yeah, I don't think that email was allowed into evidence because I think I'll have to check the transcript. Because, you know, a witness's legal conclusions are not admissible in court. And in that case, I would certainly have excluded that because it's prejudicial. That said, it shows you what they knew. They knew that this was not above board. And in fact, I imagine that one of the reasons why, and maybe it's in the record, I might have been testimony on a day that I wasn't there and haven't caught up on the transcripts. The reason why they ended up with Stormy Daniels being paid through Michael Cohen instead of AMI was that AMI's lawyers put the kibosh on it. And if they were putting the kibosh on it, I think one reason would have had to have been like, dude, Mr. Pecker, you are making an illegal campaign contribution and we could go to jail for this. So you got to stop doing this.
Wild. So generally,
wild. The whole thing is wild. You could not. You could not make this stuff up.
Yeah. So just end this part of the conversation on one of these high notes too, and just tell us, like, do you think the prosecutor, like, is it a slam dunk? Like, do they have him? Is there a way that the jury could see it the other way now?
I admit I'm kind of biased. I would convict if I were on the jury. I don't see what the actual defense is. I think, you know, one of the things you have to do when you're a criminal defense lawyer is you pick at little elements of the case. And the most that they can pick at right now is that there hasn't been anyone other than that kind of post hoc conversation between the first conversation between Pecker and and Trump at Trump Tower in 2015, and then Hope's conversation in 2018 about Trump about Trump saying, we actually said, like, would it have been better to have this come out before the election? I don't think so. I mean, between those two statements testified to about what Trump was saying and thinking, the rest of it is not direct, right? Because you've got the banker, you've got a lot of different conversations where people are saying, well, Michael Cohen told me this, Michael Cohen told me that. And so that's like one step removed from Trump. That being said, I don't know what difference that's going to make, because he signed the checks. It's clear it helped him. He admitted to pay. He admitted to Hope. That's admissible against him because it's a declaration against interest. He said it. Hope said that, you know, he knew about the payments. He signed the checks again. He talked to Pecker about the whole program of silencing these women and catch and kill. I think they got plenty enough to convict. And this is before Michael Cohen gets on the stand. And then, so I don't know what the defense really is going to be that would create. Obviously the burden is on the prosecution prove the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. That said, when you're arguing reasonable doubt to the jury, you have to articulate to the jury in your closing statement or through your cross-examinations or through your own direct case, what is that plausible, possible alternative narrative that is consistent with the facts that were heard in court. And they don't really have one. You know, even if Michael Cohen had done this on his own and made those payments, it was still an illegal campaign contribution, and Trump knew that it was an illegal, that it was made on his behalf, and Trump reimbursed it by creating false business records. So it doesn't, you know, even if Trump were telling the truth, had been telling the truth in 2018 to Hope Hicks, when he told that ludicrous lie about, oh, Michael just did this on his own, he was freelancing, that wouldn't help him. And then the other thing about this is, we haven't even gotten to Michael Cohen's testimony. And here's where I think, and I was making this point on television last night, I think Cohen might be, I mean, Cohen should be maybe the coup de grace. I mean, all of what has happened thus far has taken the weight off of Cohen's testimony, because it all corroborates his story. It all tells the story, even if Michael Cohen didn't testify, although he absolutely is a necessary witness. People will be asking, well, why didn't he testify? He didn't. The story, he's already been pre-corroborated. And now and I think the Trump people are making a big mistake publicly and in the courtroom about Cohen's testimony. They've been basically saying, oh, we're going to destroy Cohen because Cohen is such a liar. He's done this, all these bad things. And the fact of the matter is, none of it may, if Cohen keeps his cool, it's going to not really help the prosecution, because they're not going to be able to show Cohen saying anything untrue from that witness stand, I think, that witness stand that relates to this case. Because his story is simple. He's kept to it very clearly and consistently for several years now. And you've got Pecker corroborating him. You've got his own banker corroborating him. You've got Keith Davidson corroborating him. You have all these texts with Davidson and others corroborating him. And you've got Hope Hicks corroborating him. And then you've got these tapes that Michael Cohen made of Donald Trump that corroborate him. And so if Michael, I mean, they're obviously going to try to poke at Michael and harass him and make him upset so that the jury won't like him. But if he keeps his cool, he's going to kill him. And some of his testimony that, you know, kind of, he's been denigrated a bit by some of the witnesses. I don't know that that matters. I mean, they thought he was a pain in the ass. And that's his personality. He's a hard-driving, loudmouth New Yorker. He's been the first to admit that.
Do you know him?
What?
Do you know him? Do you know Michael Cohen?
I met him in 2006. I've known Michael off and on for 18 years. And, you know, he can be very likable. He can be a pain in the ass and loudmouth, but he can also be, he is also very likable and he's kind of fun. I mean, you know, they were reading some of his, he shouldn't be saying some of this stuff right now since he's about to testify. But, he's calling Trump Dr. Shits and Pants. I mean, it's actually kind of funny. But he probably shouldn't be doing that. But that said, he is who he is. I think the jury is going to be okay with it. I think it's like, okay, they already kind of know what his deal is. And if he goes in there kind of low key and just does what a witness is supposed to do, which is to basically stick to the facts, don't argue your own case. Don't argue with the cross-examiner, even if the cross-examiner is trying to provoke you, be obnoxious. I think he can be a really, I think he put the final nail in the coffin, but we'll see.
So I just have one, I have a reader question I want to ask that's just on this point before we wrap up. She said, Linda wrote in and asked, couldn't Trump have avoided the Cohen subterfuge and the whole legal mess by just writing a personal check?
Yeah, it still would have been a violation of Federal Election Campaign Act to make a contribution to your own campaign effectively without disclosing that. You're entitled, if you're running for public office, to give an unlimited money to your campaign, spend unlimited money, but you have to disclose what you've done. And he did not do that. Which would have still been an underlying Federal Election Campaign Act violation. And if he had done the same thing, I mean, at least two of those checks of the 12 or 10 or 11 checks, however, I think, yeah, oh, there were 11 checks, at least two of those checks were on his personal bank account. So, and the problem was they were maintained as part of the business records of the Trump Organization, and they had false documentation. Act with it. And then the rest was from his revocable trust, which essentially is for his benefit. So it essentially was his bank account. So I don't think the only way he could have gotten away with this and not violated the law would have been to write the check himself. And then after the election, at the next moment that's required, I don't know, maybe November 30th, I don't know what the deadline would have been, to disclose that he made this contribution and then to disclose the expenditure. And people said, who is this Stormy Daniels? And then if he had said, she had a false accusation against me and we just made her go away, that would have been legal. It would have been a lie, but to the American people, but it would have been legal.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay. George Conway, as always, thank you for explaining the legal news to me and to our listeners. Hey, don't forget to hit subscribe. Leave us a review on your podcast app. Email us at askgeorgeatthebulwark.com and get tickets for our live show on May 15th in DC. If you've bought your Vote for Joe, Not the Psycho hat, I'm sure George will sign it when we are there at 6th and I on May 15th. Thanks, guys. We'll see you next time.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last. Oh, Conway, tell them well about it. Those legal problems can't live without it. From the Emoluments to the Russian ties. and cool.